Welcome to another episode of the Mind Hack Books podcast. Today we are discussing the third book in the classic Dune series, Children of Dune. I'm so happy we got this far. I have faith you're gonna make it until the end of the sixth book. This one is from 1976, 609 pages. After the perfect setup of the first book and the depression book of the Dune Messiah, I'm very curious about what you think about this one. So, of course, joining me is Pablo and Kristina. How are you doing, Pablo?
Yeah, I'm good.
How are you, Kristina?
I am fine. Hello.
Thank you so much for coming back. I think the second discussion we had was much more on par with the standard that the discussion about Dune should have. I think when we did the first book, it was too much fanboying about Dune. And also, when I talk about it, it's usually just nonsense. I'm here just for the aliens, you know. I don't have any...
But there are no aliens.
There are aliens.
They are aliens. I believe that they are. I think the worms are aliens.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
And the Space Guild navigators, they basically became aliens. So they are aliens.
That's true. I mean, the Tleilaxu too.
And Tleilaxu also. That's completely... If they're not aliens, they are different enough to me to feel like they're aliens. So I'm very happy about those.
So Timothy Chalamet, is he an alien?
Yeah. He looks like it.
Oh, I don't know.
If the Men in Black movie franchise was still going on, I'm sure they would make it a joke that he was an alien. So he does look like that. Well, anyway, I meant to say that when you guys talked about it, it felt like a very, you know, high quality literature connoisseur conversation, unlike my bad joke. So I'm very happy you're back, so you can actually talk about it legibly, unlike I do. So I hope you can answer my questions, which I have many, and I hope we can get to the bottom of this book as well.
Okay, let's try.
No pressure, Paolo.
No pressure.
I did not reread it, and I have questions more than opinions and answers. So.
That's why we're here.
I have one very big question. We can talk about it later.
I'm sure I have answers. I don't know if they're going to be good ones, but that's why we're here to discuss it.
I don't think anyone does.
Okay. So like I mentioned, for me, the first book was a perfect setup that created a very unusually described or very realistically depicted universe with very interesting ideas. Mm. The second book was the perfect sequel for me, with the biggest BMFer in the galaxy. And then the third book, it was okay. From the four books I read, the third one is the least favorite for me. But I still liked it a lot. It's still a very good book to me. But it didn't excite me as much as the other ones. How do you feel about it?
That's kind of the question I said I don't have an answer for. I don't think anyone has an answer for. Is I think when we spoke, when we were reading and then we were talking about it, and I said, oh yeah, I think this is my favorite. And it's the only one I gave a 5-star on Goodreads, I think. Mm-hmm. I have no idea why.
And you should reread it if it's your favorite book.
I honestly have no idea why it was my favorite. When I think back now, I remember I really, really like certain points. I don't know. It didn't age well in my brain. Not as well as... some of the others.
You also said that you wanted to talk 3 hours about the tigers, so I'm not sure that was sarcastic or not, but you seemed very serious about
it. That's so dumb. Just because that's the dumbest thing in the world ever.
I think it's very eventful, and a lot of stuff that makes a lot of sense happens.
Really, I think it's the one that I think was the hardest to understand what was happening.
Oh really?
Yeah, there were several events where I was completely confused. Names and by,
well, that's always that
what was happening and where it was located, why people were doing something.
It's the first time it takes place in multiple locations, multiple planets, multiple houses, but more characters. The other two books felt much more focused to me. Yeah. This one is so more spread out.
The fourth one is also just mainly one. Two characters and just one location.
I guess that's why I don't like this one, because I really like the focus of the books, the very in-depth character.
Who are you, Aristoteles? You should be only one time, one scene and one location.
Yes, that's what I want.
Okay,
exactly.
Sure.
One character.
I like, I like the concept of it more than the book itself. Like the idea that you have this regime, this empire that somebody started, and this is the successor, this is the second generation, and what happens after that. Like that, I like that more than I like the second book, which is just basically Paul going batshit. Oh, are we using rude words today? Is that allowed?
Yes, of course.
So I like that, like, second generation. Because, like, throughout history, you see that what happens, conqueror conquers. And then, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But then the second generation is usually when things get interesting and when things get really, like, problematic. And
I also like, you know, in the second book, I like the other story, which is usually, you know, most stories are how someone comes to power, but they don't really show how they rule, how they manage things after they come to power. That's why I think the second book was very interesting. That's why I think, for example, the second and third book of Mistborn are very interesting.
One day.
Yeah, one day we'll have
Brendan, I cannot episode. Escape him.
Yeah, one day Christina will also read it.
I guess I have to, yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
When I think about, from the point of view of the writer, I think it's a very sensible sequel. It makes a lot of sense what it's about, and everything that happens, and the point of view of the new characters makes complete sense, that that's something that should be explored. But I didn't feel like that was necessarily what the writer wanted to write about. I think he wanted to write about the fourth book. I think that's like where he wanted to get to. And this was like a necessary step in between. So it's very eventful. There's so many things that happen
compared to the other books. Towards the end, like, there's so much stuff happening.
So yeah, I really like the, I kind of disliked it, the whole part about the House Corino and Faradin and all that.
Oh god, that was so unnecessary.
I like that. That was one of my favorite parts.
When I was reading it, I was kind of like, why are we doing this? Like, I don't mind it, but I don't get the point. And then I realized, oh, I'm so dumb. It's obvious that it would be interesting to see what happened to the House Corino after the fall, after all that happened before. We never really saw what they are like, and we never really saw what kind of people those that there are, and more importantly, what would it be like after what happened to them. So that's a very interesting point of view, but it was completely missed on me when I was reading it. It only occurred to me after I was thinking about it a little bit. That's a good point. I like that, that's something that's explored.
Yeah, I guess.
I do like the fact that, you know, because if we're talking about kind of like the second generation, and I guess like all of the book is about that, that's literally the title, but it's nice to see that, you know, the older generation is super interested in revenge and getting back to where they were.
So let's move on a little bit. So I have some a few tidbits about the book and the writer. I was trying to find something more about Frank Herbert that we haven't said yet. He's had all the wives and he's been high on mushrooms all the time and all this stuff. But I didn't know that he also did a lot of judo. And he was into martial arts as well. And that's supposedly why his fight descriptions make a lot of sense. So my question is, do you think the fights make sense from a like martial arts perspective?
Like, does it from my great martial arts experience?
Yes, they do. Because I know all about fighting and arts and martial stuff. So... like when they say, and then he pulled out a knife and he did a stabby stab. Accurate, 100%. 100%. Gold star.
Yeah,
awesome. I never thought about it. I like the fights a lot. So maybe that's one reason.
I think in the first Dune they are really cool. I don't know again if they're realistic or not. They just feel grounded to me, but
The first book has really good knife fights. I said it in the episode.
The second and third,
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember any memorable fights.
Even the shield fighting with the swords, it was super cool concept to me, and it was a little bit lost on the sequels. I feel like there's not much of that anymore. All the las guns and exploding the shields, I love those things, and they never come back, kind of, unless they're in the fifth and sixth book, I don't know yet.
No, okay.
So about the book a little bit. When the book came out, it sold about 75,000 copies. and the critics really liked it. It was very well like received by critics, but people kind of hated it for some reason, like the public, and they kept saying that it was dark and convoluted. And then it was nominated for the Hugo Award and for Best Novel in 1977 and started to be very popular. So I don't understand why people dislike this one, because they already were crushed by the second one. So I don't know why people would dislike this.
I'll give them convoluted. I'm not sure about dark. Doesn't feel that much darker than Dune Messiah.
Exactly, yeah. I was reading some like news reports about it, and there was a quote I wrote that the reaction was that it was unsatisfying, faulting the ending as unconvincing and thematically over-familiar, overall dark and convoluted.
I think it is much darker than Dune Messiah, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Like, it's much more hopeless than Dune Messiah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Dune Messiah was the most hopeless thing I've read in a long time for me.
I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
Well, what's
I think this one was much, much darker.
Maybe that's the answer why you gave it 5 stars.
But I don't know. I think Dune Messiah is, because it's not this hopeless, I think it's, I don't know, the ending is better. But, yeah.
Well, doesn't Children of Dune have a happy ending?
We'll talk about it.
Most of the people survive.
From certain point of view, it's a very happy ending, yes.
The dynasty is secure. So why wouldn't everybody be happy?
So one more part, one more thing I want to say is the TV show. We talked about it in our previous episode a little bit. So I rewatched it recently and I didn't remember there were so many Czech actors. So if you're a Czech listener, I think now it's like 2% of people who are Czech listening to this. But if you're Czech, I would highly recommend watching this just for the amusing cameos of random famous Czech actors. It was filmed with the help of Barrandov Studios, which is a Prague's Czech television and film production company. And I had no idea. There were so many. I messaged Kristina when I was watching it, and I sent her a screenshot. It was Marek Vašut, who is a famous actor. And I was like, what is he doing there? And then, what is that guy doing there? Have you seen Blade 2 by any chance?
Nope.
Never watched any Blade.
Marek Vašut is in Blade 2 in the start of the movie. And it's my favorite appearance of Marek Vašut in any movie in the history of movies. Because he's running away as a drug addict or something. And Blade is hunting him. And Marek Vašut jumps off a balcony and screams, "Skurva piča!" And then he's cut off. His head is cut off by Blade. And that's it. That's the role. For fair. Those who don't speak Czech, it's very awful swearing that he did. That was the whole line. He just swore like a lot, very horribly in Czech, and then he was killed by his blade, and that was his role. So in this this adaptation, he does have a role. He's the advisor of the mother of Faradin in the House Corino. I know his name. And he does a good job. And some other Czech actors are the Fremen, and I think the reason they chose them was for the Czech accent, maybe, because they look a little different and they speak a little different, so maybe they're like the Fremen people are somehow differentiated. So yeah, it was fun.
Interesting.
I would recommend it. The tiger special effects are hilarious, and
chef's kiss.
Yep. The ending I shall not talk about is also hilarious. I'll mention that at the end. But I meant to say, it gets much better. It's 3 episodes. The first episode is kind of okay. The second episode is better. And the third one I really liked. And I think it really accomplishes something that the movies will never be able to do. And that's that it feels a little bit like the book. They get into some conversations in depth. And they actually have some message to convey. It's not just... It's a lot of dialogue. And it is actually... says something that the book's saying. So that's something that they actually accomplished. I don't think was possible. So I have to give it to them for that. So yeah, if you're curious, I think it's not bad. Might be the closest to the book from all the movie adaptations, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's strange and weird.
I think it is. Yeah.
All right, so one more thing I planned today was I went to ask Pablo, because he's an expert on lore. And you also mentioned that one of your favorite things we ever did on the podcast was like a section about lore. Of course, it was connected to Brandon Sanderson.
Of course.
So I thought we should do that a little bit more. So because this book spreads out to so many planets and galaxies and so many more characters, I'm going to do like an overview of what we kind of know as far as the areas and planets and the houses go.
Okay.
So I'll try to do an overview and then have some questions. And please correct me because it's probably going to be wrong.
Okay.
So the Atreides are the main characters from the first book. They are from Caladan, which is a green planet built of water. And they come to Dune. Have they spread to any other planets?
No. I mean, they probably have influence over other planets. Like, it's kind of assumed that they are one of the great houses, so the great houses might have influence over other planets, but it's never talked about, like, whether they did or not. I don't think so, at least.
Like, why doesn't Paul have any, like, official cousins? Feels like he should have official cousins out of the wazoo, and he doesn't.
Yeah, exactly that my point. So I was strange. Just curious. I'm sure Paolo would know, so...
No, I don't know. No. I think it's just he wanted to keep it simple so that there was only one line of Atreides. I mean, you can come up with a lot of possible answers, like they were killed. Like in the first book, they talk often about the War of Assassins, where noble houses would just kill each other using assassins without going into an all-out war. So you could say all of the cousins and all of the cadet branches got murdered.
Okay. So the second most prevalent, of course, is House Harkonnen, and those are originally from the planet Jedi Prime, which I think is a hilarious name nowadays. Like, it's called G-I-E-D-I Prime. Is it pronounced Jedi?
It's Jedi, yeah. I mean, the Jedi in Star Wars
are they?
Coming
that's
from
so
that.
Lame.
Exactly. This is like a hilarious thing to me. Yeah, I always think this is funny. Because people generally, like, of course, people who read books and people who know a little bit, they know Star Wars is basically Dune. But people who love Star Wars, they don't know it's so similar. And then there's a planet literally called Jedi.
Yeah. Like,
but that's not consistent, the pronunciation of that. Like if you're going to read it the English way, you would probably pronounce it Jedi. And if you were going to read it the Italian way...
Yeah, it would be Jedi.
Yeah, okay, Jedi. How similar is it? Yeah. Like, okay, it's funny.
Well, it is similar, but...
But in Italian, to be fair, like, Jedi are also called Jedi, so...
Yeah,
in Czech as well. Mostly, it depends on the dubbing
I
version.
Remember we were saying Jedi, because that's how we say it in Czech. But anyway, so the Harkonnen, I was also surprised they don't have a bunch of planets, or they don't spread out around the galaxy. Do you know of any other planets there that's under them?
Again, I don't think it's ever mentioned. I think in the first movie, in the first book, it is mentioned that in retaliation for something that Harkonnen did, the Atreides destroy some spice reserves that the Harkonnens had.
Oh yeah, there was something about it.
And that was not on Jedi Prime, it was on some other planet. So that is mentioned.
Warehouse planet?
Yeah. I like how, you know, this is... kind of a tangent about sci-fi in general, but it's always funny to me when you have these settings about different planets and things. Usually planets, they're basically just like a country, or even less than that, basically just kind of like a small region. Like, for example, if it's a hot planet, it's just a hot planet. Or you know, like, they make it sound always so small, but when you think about it, think about the fact
no
that
climate.
Like, our diverse and like structured Earth is like, but every other planet is just like this thing is like an
that's
island.
That's very true. Yeah. And to be fair, in this book they changed it.
Yeah,
the planet has diversity now.
No. But for I think for Arrakis he did a very good job. It's just like for the other planets, and in general for most sci-fi stories, like Star Wars, is like that. For example.
Yeah, it's just this planet is dead.
Yeah, like the planet appears and. Yeah, it's just one city. Like, if there is a war for a planet, it's just a fight for the main city, and that's it. Like, it's a whole planet, but yeah.
So next planet is called Tleilax. So it's the shapeshifting Tleilaxu.
But okay, they're not all shapeshifters. Shapeshifters are only one group, and they're slaves.
Okay, sorry. face dancers, shapeshifters, and etc.
Like there are the face dancers who are the shapeshifters and their slaves. Then there are the masters who control the face dancers. And then, like in the fifth book, a bit more is explained about their society, which is very important. And I won't spoil until you read the fifth book.
You already hinted. Yeah, I already hinted in our previous episode. I'm so excited. I can't wait.
That makes sense. Like, if the master shifts their face, then how do you know It's the master. Makes sense.
Can't wait to get into book five. But yeah. The house that's new in this book, in Children of Dune, is the House Corino. That's the most in-depth explored in the previous books. Mm-hmm. They're basically just mentioning them. So they are responsible for the Sardaukar, if I pronounce it correctly.
Yeah.
They basically have the most powerful army, and they were plotting with the Harkonnen to basically take down the Atreides, and they were supplying the Harkonnen with Sardaukar, and then it all went to hell, and now they're kind of unable to do anything, but they're trying to just get back in there and take their place again.
Well, yeah, because that's the family that the former emperor was out of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So House Corino was the family, and they are Sarusa Secundus. That's one of those things that's never completely explained, so I guess it's kind of like the kind of answer you want to give to this question, but Sarusa Secundus was supposed to be the prison planet. It was not supposed to be the seat of House Corino. It was never clear where the emperor would usually be with his family. Mm. But Sarusa Secundus was supposed to be this awful planet, which was just a prison planet, and that's also where the Sardaukar came from, although no one knew about it, because the idea was, if you can survive on this hellish place, then you are strong enough to be the strongest soldier there is, which also applies kind of to the Fremen. But then in this book, Sarusa Secundus is not a hellish place. It's not the best, but it's kind of like a normal planet. And
they don't talk about it much, do they? They just talk about the place where they reside.
Yeah. If that's where they live, it's
like nicer part of the barracks,
I guess. But why would the palace of House Corino be there?
I mean, they have, after what happened to them, maybe they don't have any better place to be.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one theory. Like, that's one answer you can give, that after what happened, they were forced to move to Sarusa Secundus. But that's never said. The other answer you can give is the fact that Sarusa Secundus was this hellish place was always a lie. They were always lying about it because they didn't want other families to find out where they were training and keeping the Sardaukar.
That makes sense too. Yeah,
but
that does actually make sense, because yeah.
So that's what I meant with the beginning.
I like that.
It makes all the sense that this is the house that should be explored now, because it was so important in the first two books, and we never really talked about it that much. So okay, so I think that's all the houses for now. There'll be more in the next book and stuff, but is there anything I forgot?
Maybe, like, connecting Irulan to the House Corino, in case people forgot. That's who she is, that's where she's from. So, you know, she could have helped them out, right? She was the wife of the Emperor, and she didn't.
Yeah, and she was also Bene Gesserit. So she has a lot of allegiances, but it's kind of clear which one she chose in this book. One planet that you forgot to mention, it's the least explored. It's mentioned more in book four, but it's already mentioned at the beginning of book two. It's Ix.
Oh yeah,
which is the planet of kind of like engineering. Like, Trelax is kind of like biologics and chemical and that side of science, and Ix is kind of like the hard science in terms of engineering, and not computers, but like, you know, sort of those things. Like, those, they are the ones who build like spaceships
because
and stuff.
Computers are evil.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you so much for answering all my questions. I hope this helps you, to the readers, if you're reading the series and you want to refresh yourself before the third book, or if you want to just have a better idea what kind of people are where and what. So yeah. Thanks for that.
No problems.
Great. I guess we can move on to the plot. I don't have to ask if you recommend this.
Yeah. You can get... Wait. I'll stick to what I always say. Like, if you read the first one, you should read the second. You can stop there. I think it's fine. But if you read the third one, you should read the fourth. So if you read this one, you should get ready to read one more, at least. I don't think it makes sense to read just this one.
Hmm.
Yeah, I completely agree.
It makes sense.
Because there's some plot twists coming.
I know that originally it was supposed to be conceived as two trilogies with the fourth book in the middle. So seven books with first three break, and then next three. And yeah. I guess chronologically it makes sense if you look at the timeline. But just in terms of story and in terms of main characters, it doesn't really make sense. If you read this book and then you don't really know what happens in the fourth book, nothing really makes sense and nothing really has a purpose. So
yeah, I just want to mention that the reason I think all of us like this so much is the series, not just the individual books. So I think it works really well as a whole. So if you like it, just keep going. I think there's no other recommendation.
There's fun world building in there. World building.
And still, for me, it's the most tightly connected story. Like, even though it jumps 3,000 years in the future and stuff like that, it's still connected very well together and everything kind of pays off, which I still cannot find in stories too much.
Because you haven't read enough Brandon Sanderson.
Oh my god! Okay, let's move on.
Also, I'm not sure if everything pays off. There are a lot of things that don't pay off, to be honest.
Yeah. But it's like very focused on the, you know, you set something up and then you used it. That's all I want.
But there are a lot of things that are set up and then just disappear.
Yeah, but I think there are more that they don't disappear. That's true. And the important things stay and they are used. And there is a through line of things. So the things that disappear, they play into the main storyline and they mean something.
Yeah.
It's not like there is a side plot that nobody cares. Like, if you cut it out, nothing will change. Like, if you cut out Foradin and House Corrino from this, it kind of feels like something's missing. Even though it's not as important and it's not mentioned later, it's still a part that makes a lot of sense. It contributed to all the events. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so let's move on to spoilers. If you're reading this book, please stop listening. Come back after you read it. And I'd like to talk about a quick theory I read on Reddit about Jessica. I'm curious what you think.
Okay.
Because I was kind of angry or disappointed that Jessica wasn't in the second book. And I was kind of trying to find out what people think or why, what happened and why is she here now? Like, it's kind of strange. So somebody wrote like a few pages about it. So I'll try to explain. Hopefully it will make sense. So they were trying to explain that Jessica is kind of a type of person who needs people to support her. And she's always clingy, or she's always with somebody. And she's never really been on her own fully. So every time something bad happens and somebody important in her life leaves, it really shakes up her life. And she's kind of messed up about it so much that she has to completely switch to something else. So when her husband died, she completely relied on Paul.
Not her husband.
Okay, sorry. When Leto died, it was the center of her life and she couldn't deal with it. So she just attached herself to Paul and she followed Paul around. And the thing that kind of saved her was that Paul became the, you know, Muad'Dib. And then when Paul is gone, she has nothing to, like, do other than Alia. But Alia is an abomination and she becomes crazy and she kind of knows that it's going to happen, so she doesn't want to deal with that. So the only place she can go is the Sisterhood, and that's why she comes back to the Bene Gesserit. And they also say in this super analysis that Baron Harkonnen is the same, that he always needs some kind of support and some kind of person to lean on. And if he doesn't have anybody, he tries really hard to find that new person. Basically, they're trying to paint the analogy that Jessica and the Baron, they just always want a lot of control in their life, and they always want to be independent, and they always want to have all the power, but they can never do it. And that's why they do what they do, because they always fail at getting all the control and power they want. That's the theory. So that's why she disappeared, because she was like, I'm out, I can't deal with this, I'm back to the Bene Gesserit. That's why she left in the second.
I agree with almost nothing.
I would call that a reach. I would call that a reach.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, when Jessica and Paul escaped into the desert, they very much escaped into the desert, just the two of them, and she was pregnant, and Paul was 15. How much was she relying on him, and how much was she accompanying her son, who, even though he's a special super messiah, was a child, and she was pregnant, and like they worked together. Like without Jessica, the Fremen wouldn't have bought into Paul, because Jessica used that kind of missionary lore stuff that Bene Gesserit like spread around the planets, and she was like, oh, look at my child, do not kill my child, because he is the special messiah. I wouldn't say she was like hanging on to him. They very much built a power base together while she was grieving and pregnant, and then she was raising her daughter somehow, whatever happened there, no idea. And then I guess she just checked out. She had enough of that religious mania and craze. So she checked out, but I wouldn't say she was, you know, hanging on to people, clinging. Yeah.
I was kind of like iffy about this theory, so now you completely changed my mind. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. Take that, Reddit. You're wrong.
I don't buy that.
No, I agree. I think it's interesting, like kind of like what Christina was saying about that she was out on raising Alia. I think that's the interesting part in the sense that, especially if you see what happens in this book, because on one side you can say, well, she didn't want to be with Alia because she was despised by the Bene Gesserit, but then kind of like the biggest moment of her life was defying the Bene Gesserit in having Paul in the first place, right? So she betrayed like everything she was raised about to have Paul. And honestly speaking, I think it's interesting also in the sense that I don't think this is ever explored, so this is just completely my kind of like my headcanon. But it must have been really shitty to be Alia's parent. Because imagine a parent, like you're being a parent and your 3-year-old child knows most things better than you. And she goes around and kills people. That's hard. So yeah, she left, and it you feel kind of bad because then you realize that her leaving Alia basically left her, like no one could understand her, and now no one could contain her other than maybe Paul, but then even Paul left. So you do realize that that was the wrong decision, but at the same time it's kind of understandable. Can you really be a parent for this person, or would you just run away?
Okay, so I think one way or the other, we have answered why Jessica wasn't there, which I wanted to. I was thinking about that. Yeah. Too. Thanks. Okay, so I'll try to recap the story step by step. If you want to talk about something, please do. But bear in mind that the more we do, the longer you have to stay with me. So it's up to you. So 5-second recap of the first two books. The Atreides come to Dune because they are forced into it. Everybody dies. Paul becomes Superman, superhero, super god, legend, messiah. And then in the second book, his wife dies giving birth, and he's blind, and he walks into the desert, and everybody's depressed. That's where we're at. So book 3 starts, and Chane gave birth to twins, Leto and Ganima. And I felt really bad for Stilgar. This whole book, I feel like poor Stilgar. He can't deal. Like he should have left with Jessica. So Stilgar is watching the twins in the cradle, and he's thinking to himself, if I just killed them, it would have been so much easier. Like, I can do it right now. You remember that?
Yeah.
And it was so bad, but it makes so much sense. He knew what would go down.
Yeah, like, I do remember that.
This is so bad for Stilgar.
Yeah.
So he doesn't kill the children, but yeah, I'm not very happy about them. I think we skip a little bit forward, so the children grow up a little bit. And we start with Alia. We already talked about this in the second book, that she's kind of the head of the church at first, and then she gets more and more power. And now she's the official regent of the empire. Mm-hmm. So she's just in charge.
Yeah. That was already evident in the second book. But in the third one, she's married to Duncan.
But still way too
horny. Which is incredible. Like, Duncan is kind of like the... Like, if you read the fourth book and then the fifth book and the sixth book, like, Duncan is I don't know, like the main character of every porn movie ever.
Yes.
So, you know, it's kind of impressive that she's still not satisfied after that. So...
I wish so much that they stick with the movies. They make all 6 movies.
It will never happen.
Name, Mr. Mimosa.
It will never happen.
Yeah.
The 6th movie is going to be a porn movie. It's going to be great.
It will never happen.
No, but like compare exactly. Duncan from the TV adaptation and Jason Momoa. Like compare them. What would you say, Incha? It's like the comparison of sky and bagpipes. Why do we say that?
That's a good idiom. In Japanese, it's the moon and the mud turtle.
Yeah. Okay, I like it. What's it like in Italian?
English is just night and day. It's just very boring.
There is another one. It has something to do with food. I forgot.
English also has chalk and cheese.
That kind of makes sense. Kind of fun. Yeah. Okay. So Duncan, I don't think it was much explored in the second book, but basically they have sex all the time with Alia.
Like, all the time. Yeah, good. So, nice.
So they become husband and wife, which also was kind of skipped. They just mentioned Mandan and Beric.
In the second book, it was kind of implied that that was going to happen.
Yeah, but it just happened like in the background. Yeah.
Also, for those who just now are joining us, Duncan is a
zombie. Not a zombie. It's a kind of a clone.
Well,
a
not
clone
zombie,
with
but
the memories of the original one.
He's a gola.
Yeah.
Well, it's not really a clone. Like, this is still like the original body, just with like metal eyes.
So Alia is hearing all these voices. We already talked about what it means to be an abomination. And also Leto and Ghani, who are the children, they also are kind of worried about becoming an abomination, but they kind of restrain themselves from it. So they have a way to, like, especially Leto, he doesn't want any of it. He's trying, he knows that it's dangerous, so he kind of limits his Frisians. He doesn't eat so much spice. Mm-hmm. He's kind of trying to be away from all this nonsense. I think the sister has some kind of hypnosis or some system.
Well, they during the story, they develop a, both develop a different way to kind of
block.
Yeah,
that's what I mean. That's
so
what I mean.
In Ganima's case, she uses a Chani's personality. Basically, Chani protects her.
Yeah,
like, Chani
stops
all of the other memories from disturbing her.
Right.
Leto does something similar, but what he does is he uses, that's something also, if you want to talk about things that are discussed, but that, like, introduced, but then never expanded upon.
Okay.
Leto goes back in time to, not prehistory, but like the first civilizations, and one of the earliest memories he has, which are, which, who is this guy who was, I don't know, some emperor or king of like the Sumerians, and who's a super like dictator, crazy, power hungry person.
Hmm.
And he uses that guy kind of as a guardian because he kind of like wants to dominate everything.
I remember something.
Yeah,
yeah,
it was kind of like that. He mentions the name, I completely forgot, but that's what he does. He uses that memory kind of as a way to control everything else. So it's similar in the sense that they are kind of using one persona to control all of the others. But in Ganima's case, Chani is more like a, you know, mother's love and kind of like protecting her. In Leto's case, it's more like a domination. Like, this memory is kind of like dominating everything else.
Whatever they do, they have a way to prevent this. Meanwhile, Alia, not as much. Moreover, the situation now is that, like you mentioned in the second book, the planet has changed. There is water now, there are forests, people don't have shortage of water. The Fremen completely changed their ways of life. They are kind of meek now. They completely changed what they do. They have a surplus of water. They just live normal life. They have normal jobs. They are very unhappy about that.
Some of them are happy.
Some of them, but most of them...
Yeah. Some of them are not, especially because there are tourists coming to Arrakis to visit the siege.
I remember this phrase, the children
are
fast.
I think Stilgar says that, does he not?
And I was like, one of the
crazies.
Crazies. He's like, oh, they have too much water. Yeah, they are too hydrated.
A lot of fanatics following Muad'Dib still, and there is a secret place we get to later called Jakarutu or Jakartu.
Jakurutu.
So those Fremen are still trying to hold to their ways and separate themselves from society. So there is still like a small group of Fremen that are the...
To me, that's like the most confusing thing, because first, so there is this whole plot where there is this group of Fremen who want to, as you said, kind of like keep the old ways and stay true to the life of the desert and so on. And they're kind of like kidnapping tourists and killing them and doing that kind of stuff. And there is this kind of old story among the Fremen of Jakurutu, and there were like the, I forgot how many, but it says like there were the five clans of the Fremen, six clans of the Fremen, whatever it was. The Jakurutu clan tried to control all of them, and then they were removed from Fremen history. Like, there is this subplot, and so now Jakurutu is kind of like the lost siege because no one knows where it is.
I think there's like some taboo involved, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's a taboo.
Of like something like with water that they were stealing.
They were stealing water. They were doing something really shit. I forgot exactly what it was. But anyway, the super confusing part for me was Leto at one point goes in search of Jakurut, right? And he gets captured by the Fremen from this group, who you would assume are in Jakurut, and is held in this place. But then he's brought to a different siege, and they say that that's the real Jakurut, and the previous place was something different, and then actually there were two places, like... That part I could never understand.
The only answer I have is that, I had the same thought, and I justified it that they just trying to hide the real place, so they keep claiming it's this or that, so they wouldn't find the real Jakarutu. And there's multiple places, multiple secret sieges, and it's like a decoy siege.
I mean, that could make sense, but I don't know, it was just so confusing.
I agree. Well, I meant to say, it makes a lot of sense to me, because the setup makes sense that this is where it went, and there are people who are fanatically following Wadeep, and there is of course the rebel group that is against that, which is Jakurutu. So in the middle of all of this mess, Jessica decides to come back to Arrakis and see her daughter Alia, and everybody's immediately just thinking about what is her purpose, why is she here, what's happening.
What? The daughter I abandoned isn't happy to see me?
The situation is very tense, and everything's kind of terrible.
Yeah. Well, and she has renewed her allegiance to the group that thinks I'm an abomination and should be killed.
Yeah, I can see now why you said this is darker than the first one, but the second one. But the second one still felt darker to me.
I don't agree at all. I don't think the second one is that dark.
I want to say I like that everything, like the motivations behind the events are so clearly, like, so strong, like in these books, like. Like, this setup makes it so understandable what the people do, because it's insane, like, the situation they're in. So that's what I like, that the circumstances are so clearly pushing them into what they're doing that it makes complete sense what the people are doing. It never felt to me like some of the things that they do are not justified. And I think that's one of the things I really like about the series.
That's a very good point.
So cut to House Corino, where they know the situation happens. And they're plotting how to take down the House of Atreides again. And what do? They have the tigers.
Yes. They have the best idea ever.
Kitties!
Okay, so they want to assassinate Ganima and Leto. It's okay. I mean, that's their plot. Makes sense. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of ways they could go on about this. Of course, some of the usual methods for assassination wouldn't work with them. They can't poison them, for example, because they can rearrange their metabolism, and so probably poison wouldn't work. But their idea is, let's take these two tigers, strain them, which are, by the way, they only exist on Salusa Secundus, so, I mean, they don't exist on Dune. We're going to bring them to Dune, and...
Yeah.
Before bringing them to Dune, we are going to train them to kill two children who look like Ganymede and Leto. And there is a guy, like a hidden guy, who's kind of controlling them, like telepathically or something. I forgot, but yeah. Yeah, like all of this makes so little sense. If you want to talk about something that's convoluted, like this plan is the most convoluted thing in the world. Like, it had zero chances of success. Like, so many things had to go right.
Yes, this part is insane.
And it succeeded because they realized it was happening and they wanted to use the plan.
When are they getting the children?
It almost succeeded. Like,
otherwise,
where are they getting the children from?
Very good question, because they're training the tigers on actual children, right? They actually get children.
Like, step one, secure they're using real children. Unlimited supply of children that look like the current ruling family and hope that nobody notices. Step two.
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. You have a whole planet. You can find
them. Get a guy that can telepathically control three tigers. Are they like, can he control any animal or just these three tigers?
No. I think those tigers, like, they're special. That's why they're only on Salusa Secundus.
And he's got some kind of remote control in his hand, right?
Yeah. He had, like, some machine. Like, that was I think, the easy part of the plan.
Get a chip inside the special tiger. Step three, get the tigers onto the planet and hope nobody notices. And nobody, like, obviously people notice, but nobody is going to tell anyone. It's like, there's tigers we're transporting. Like these special tigers that only live on Salusa Secundus.
Exactly. That also makes...
Like, I'm sure there's... Someone could have seen them. At some point, there's like step for profit. I'm like... Okay, well, what happens once they assassinate them?
Like, no, because then the other idea... No, like the part after that was so... This is already crazy, but then the idea is that they have to drag the two children out of their... Because they're in Siege Tabr. So they have to drag them out of Siege Tabr without all of their allies and friends and so on. Maybe just like one other person. Then the tigers have to somehow defeat that person. Like they have to catch exactly this moment, exactly the right place where no one can help them. No one can see that the tigers have killed them, because that's the other step. Like, the tigers have to kill the children without anyone noticing, or like everyone has to be killed so that there are no witnesses. And then they have to do so in a place where there's also a worm, so that the worm can eat the tigers. That was the last step.
Yeah, so there's no evidence.
Yeah, so there is.
But you left out the most hilarious part to me, that they have to wear something.
Yeah. Like the children had to wear like a specific thing, which was like the other crazy part. And so that was like a present that they have sent. Like they send some things as presents.
They sent them a celebratory cloak or some wool or something, like a piece of clothing, and they have to wear that, and only then like the tigers will attack them, because they will recognize these clothes.
So convoluted. like this
what
plan
are you
had
talking about?
No chance at all to work.
Not only that, like, okay, does it work? Doesn't it work? Whatever. Who thought of this plan? This is like,
and even if everything worked right, like, they could still not be killed. Yeah. Like, they could survive. One of them could escape.
And, like, what was the plan for after?
It was
so
just
we
crazy.
Have assassinated the heirs to the throne. And then?
She's going to be easier to get rid of because she doesn't have the two Parisian children
and then,
with her.
Well, I guess Alia is in charge now and
she's
crazy.
Do people
know
that she's crazy? Like, how many people actually know that she's all Baron Harkonnen?
Nobody knows that.
Well, they don't know, but she's not... Well... She's clearly not very mentally stable. That's apparent to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think she's not as dangerous as the twins, is the point.
Well, dangerous.
Whatever. So this
she's
plan
dangerous.
Is
it depends who's dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, who's dangerous for.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think we can all agree that this is, like, a part of the whole series that's, like, nonsense.
Yeah.
I don't...
This is the biggest nonsense. This is by far the biggest nonsense in all of you.
Like, we finally found something
Well, I mean, there is another plan you will see at the end, very end of book 5.
Oh, no.
Which is also incredibly amazing.
So when I was reading this, I was trying to justify it somehow. I kept thinking, maybe they are trying to make the most convoluted plan, so it's the most difficult to predict with the prescience and looking into the future. And Leto's already not looking into the future as much, so he'll see some tigers and he'll be like, whatever tigers, I don't care, and then he'll get killed. I don't know. It's just it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so this, I'll just say what happens now, because it makes more sense to say together. So tigers attack, but everybody expects it. Leto kills one of the tigers, then there's some shenanigans. Well, they kill both of the tigers, just to sum it up. And then they agree that Ganima will self-hypnotize herself to forget that Leto II didn't die, and she will pretend that he was killed by the tigers. Mm-hmm. And it's all part of the plan that Leto is plotting. And it's going to come up later. So that's what happens.
Yeah. Because Leto was looking for a way to look for Jakurutu without the adults stopping him.
Yeah.
And also without Alia finding out. Because they at this point, they had realized that Alia was going crazy.
So this was much later in the book. But basically, this is the result of this tiger of the shenanigan plot.
No, it was very convenient for the story. It, it was just dumb.
So basically, Leto had to leave in the desert and pretend he was dead. And this is how they did it, which is hilarious.
Amazing.
So meanwhile, Jessica comes back and she talks to Alia. And I like those conversations between them and all the tension and what it all meant. As we already said, Alia becomes crazier and crazier, hearing all kinds of voices, and then one strong voice emerges from the chaos, and Baron Harkonnen slowly takes control of her. It starts with him just really craving having sex, so he pushes Alia to have sex with everybody he meets, basically.
Yeah. Especially young boys.
And we already mentioned she's so horny that she just says yes.
And Duncan starts to realize, there's something off here.
Duncan sees that, yeah. So all these things escalate to the point where everybody realizes that Alia's just lost. And there is no helping her. And the Fremen rebels are kind of attacking. And the Jessica just trying to take some control. And then other Fremen who are still true to the Atreides come in and they have some discussions. All kinds of chaos. What happens at the end is that they need to escape because Alia even tries to kill her mother.
Yeah.
So Alia is completely insane. So some Fremen, what is the word? Fedaikin?
Yeah, Fedaikin. Like they used to be the death commando under Paul, but now they're the head of the church.
They realized that there is no way in following Alia, and they are still loyal to Jessica, so they help Jessica escape with Duncan. And Duncan is completely messed up about everything, and he gets an idea that the only place they wouldn't look for them or assassinate them as easily would be to go to the planet Salusa Secundus, yeah, to the House Corino. And then there is Faradon, who is a very naive boy being schooled by all kinds of people, and they arrive there. And they get arrested. And there is a scene. They tie Duncan and Jessica to a chair and they interrogate them. Why did you come here? What are you doing here? What does this mean? All makes sense. And Duncan is so messed up. He tries to cut his wrists with the restraints because he is so sad about Alia and everything that's happening that he just wants to die. And he tries to kill himself repeatedly there. Mm-hmm. And it was very strange to me. I guess it makes sense. Like, I didn't think he would have done that, or why then and there. I don't know. I didn't understand what he was doing. Okay, yeah. So then they talk it all out, and basically Jessica starts helping Faradon learn all kinds of things, including the Bene Gesserit ways. And they all agree that they will work together to take down Alia, because they all want that.
Okay, so we haven't talked about another big character in the book, which also appears in this part. That's the prophet, like the blind prophet. Yeah, who's voicing like the opposition within the religion to what Alia is doing, and how the cult of Muad'Dibas kind of lost its way, and people suspect that this guy is actually Paul. And then he is brought to Salusa Secundus, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember.
And he speaks like to the people there and so on. And
that was kind of interesting.
You kind of realize that he's Paul.
Yeah, we all know that.
I was really hoping he wouldn't be like. I just really liked the way it ended for Paul in the second book. I think it was a very fulfilling ending. And the fact that he somehow survived. Again, that's why I said this book is so much darker than the previous one. Because in the previous one, like, of course, his wife died and it's sad. But then he kind of solved a lot of issues. And then he's taking himself out of the picture. And it's it's a sad ending for him. But at the same time, he's accomplishing something. Instead, in this way, you find out that not only he didn't die, he survived, and he became even more of an addict, and he's super bitter and just hates everything.
I would say it's more like kind of true to life. Like, really, how tragic. Many stories are there where somebody's like, "And I'm totally gonna retire. I'm out of here. Not going to influence this thing anymore. I'm sick of it." And then, like, 5 years later, so. Here's where you're all doing it wrong, and like, you know, he just can't retire.
No, that's 100% true. So everything about his character in this book is really sad.
I think Frank Herbert needed somebody to have the speeches about philosophy, and that was
that's true. That's
100% true. It was the character to do that,
and I like them.
That's the best part.
Okay, so he basically has speeches in the public, and it felt strange to me that nobody stopped him. They kind of allowed it, like way too long they allowed it. He just waltzes in there while Alia is having some kind of event, and he just talks to everybody, interrupts everything, and everybody's like, okay,
that,
I guess
that makes sense to me as well. Because like, if you try to silence him, then maybe you're silencing him because he has something interesting to say. Maybe you don't want to let him speak, so you're
okay.
Yeah,
so we skipped kind of the plot with Faradon and his mother, which I didn't care about much.
Well, Jessica convinces them that she can teach Faradon and make him into a Bene Gesserit, kind of like what she did with Paul, and that's kind of alluring. And then she, but the mother is worried that she will corrupt, so to speak, his son, which happens. So she was 100% right. One thing that, because before we were talking about the preacher and kind of his speeches, one thing that I don't know if you noticed, but this book is the one that more than the first two books, there is a lot of building of the actual planet, like the traditions and like even small events like festivals and how normal people are living their lives. I think there's some of it in here. In the first two books, there was basically nothing. You could see that the people in power and their lives and the main characters, but you knew nothing about the rest of the planet. There was like what people were doing and their culture, their traditions, other than the Fremen. So I think that was interesting.
Okay, so I guess we can move on to almost the ending.
To the ending? Okay.
Well, after Leto leaves to the desert, you already mentioned he gets captured by the Fremen. So he goes to Jakurutu, and...
Well, first of all, there is the part where, like, he's being captured, and you... So, at the beginning, it's not clear if these Fremen are in league with Gernak and the... Because Gernak was sent to kind of, like, protect Leto when they started the whole plot.
Yeah, Gernihalik.
Gurney.
He was sent there to kind of protect him, and you kind of expect that they are in league with the, like, in cahoots with the smugglers. But then, well, that, talking about plot points that go nowhere, in the first book, like, we are introduced to the smugglers, spice smugglers, and then in the second and third book, they kind of vanish. Anyway, and then actually, no, like, Leto is actually being held here as a prisoner.
And there's a girl there, isn't there?
I think, did they try to seduce her? I forget.
That's so much creepier since he's 9 years old.
I just remember, like, this part, this is the most confusing part. Like, these chapters where he's being held in this prison and they are force-feeding him a lot of spice, that's when he starts seeing all the shit. And
this is the golden path.
This
is
when he realizes about the golden path. And, like, none of this makes sense. I just couldn't understand anything about what was happening here.
So I guess we should talk about the golden path a bit. This is a huge theme, slightly mentioned in the previous books as well.
Well, it wasn't clearly mentioned. It's kind of implied later.
So Leto, like we said, he doesn't want to get into the visions, and then they force him to, and he finally can see mostly everything. Yeah. He just can see the future of the humankind and all these things that are going together, and it's insane and it's all bad. And he cannot deal with it. So in his fever spice dreams, he tries to find any solution to it. And he thinks of a solution that he calls the golden path. And this is supposed to be a solution to society, how to make them make people not just lose their way, society crumble and everything go to hell. And this is the only way he can see to guide nations to not destroy themselves.
It's not, no,
and
no,
this
no.
This is ultimately the
That's
plan.
That's not like this nations to destroy themselves. Like, there was a big danger that's never explained, at least in these books.
I understand it as people just being the danger to themselves.
No.
Then I don't know what it is.
Like, what he sees is that the Imperium will be destroyed by something, and the human race will be erased by this something. And there's only one way to make sure that this doesn't happen. That's the thing.
Okay, but they never explained what that was.
Well, read book 5 and 6.
I assumed it was like giving humanity something like a common enemy to make them, you know.
Exactly.
So, yes and no. Like, the problem was that humanity would end up stagnating and then not going anywhere. And so they would, like, it would be possible to completely annihilate them. And that's what happens later. Yeah, that's what causes what happens in book 4. That explains the ending of book 4. And that explains what happens in book 5 and 6.
So, the mechanism of what he does once he sees the golden path. Are we at that point yet?
Yes.
You can't tell me that nobody's ever stuck their hand into a pool of sand trout. Like, you can't tell me that's never happened before.
That's what you mean? No. But, okay, if that's what you're talking about, that's not the thing. So if a normal, because he says that that's a common game for Fremen children, there is a big difference. So it's explained that he has Bene Gesserit powers, right? Bene Gesserits can control their metabolism to the cellular level. So what he does is that he manipulates his cells to merge with, and his like DNA to merge with that of the sand trouts. So that's why other children couldn't do it, because if you're a Bene Gesserit, you can somehow control your cells. It's kind of like what they do with poison, right? They transform the poison into something different. So that's what he does. Like,
not everybody can do
that. Like the sand trouts become part of his body because of that. So I think the part is fine. Like, I don't think it's... like, there's a
clear explanation. I completely forgot about that. I just thought, like, he lets... Because, like, they burrow under his skin.
He, like, kind of lets them,
and
I
then
guess.
They all merge.
So he just builds a superpower armor of worms, basically.
Well, but first he's brought to the real Jakurutu, and he finds out that the preacher was being, which is Paul, was being held there, and because they found him when he walked into the desert, and they basically were corrupting him with spice, because he needed spice to survive, and so he became the preacher because these Fremen were kind of keeping him completely drugged and high on spice for days and days. And also, one small thing that is explained, I don't remember if here or later when he actually meets the preacher and he speaks with him, that Paul also has seen the golden path. It's just that Paul refused to do what he was supposed to do in order to pursue the golden path.
You can't really blame him.
No.
Yep.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So this is what they talk about eventually when they meet. Yeah. But before that, he becomes like a super-powered superhero by the power of worms. When I was reading this, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what was happening. And it was like, I was like, what are you doing? Like, I kind of calmed down after the tiger incident. And then this happened. And I was like, Frank Herbert, did you have too many mushrooms? What's happening? Like, he literally starts running across the desert at the speed of light.
The speed of light.
But he runs like a madman.
Yeah.
Speed of worm. He runs super fast. He can just basically get anywhere as fast as he wants. He's indestructible. He punches people with the power of God. He makes stuff explode. He controls the worms. He can tell them what to do. It's like, but it was depicted as if he was invincible already.
And
like,
he is 9 years old.
Yeah. Exactly.
And Alia like, is the abomination. Like, she just got Baron Harkonnen in there. But, like, she's the bad guy.
Well, I mean, she killed Baron Harkonnen when she was two and
like,
a half.
So she kills one guy when she's a little girl. Then when she grows up, she wants to fuck all the time. And then she gets a tiny bit possessed. And she's the abomination. Like, women can't have hobbies. Bit. You know? Just can't have hobbies.
So he starts running around the desert like a complete madman.
Yeah.
And he makes a bunch of the sieges explode and destroys all of the...
He doesn't destroy the sieges. He destroys the canals that were bringing water to the
sieges.
No
terraforming for you.
He just wreaks havoc. Insanity ensues.
Hydration makes you weak.
This was happening.
You forgot about hydration. Makes you weak.
Until this point, all these books felt so grounded in reality.
Really?
Yes, to me, yes. Even the tigers.
Like people
like,
okay, into
what
the
about
future,
like the navigators?
Or yeah, it's justified. Like yes, also justified. It's like a thing that happens gradually over millennia.
Okay.
Like it's like a thing I talked about in the first episode we talked about Dune. Like all these things pile up, and they take so long, and they just devolve, just. Stuff happens.
That's a
fair point. Sci-fi, just the stuff evolves. And seeing the future, it kind of makes sense based on what's been going on. And becoming a space navigator by overdosing on this chemical for years and years and millennia, becoming a fish person from it, because you're floating in a tank in space and you've lived in space so long that you don't even have gravity anymore, you only have spice. Okay, you're a fish person, it took so long. But he became a Superman out of worms in 5 seconds, and then everything exploded.
I mean, okay, if you put it that way, it's true.
If it took him at least 20 years or something, I don't know.
At the same time, if you think it another way, like, it took the Bene Gesserit, like, thousands of years to genetically build Paul and his children. Like, it took them literally thousands of years. So if you saw it that way, it is the result of thousands of years of evolution in that direction. It just takes the last step. Like, he was already, like, again, the things he can do were already completely inhuman.
Yes, that's true. But I guess I mind the physicality of it. Like, there wasn't anything as physically insane until now.
Okay. Wait until you read book 5.
Oh my god. Because in book 4, even crazier things happen, but they take a lot of time. So it kind of makes sense. But here... Okay. So whatever. He runs around like a madman, kicks people in the face. Like, the TV show adaptation is hilarious. Please, if you've read this book, look up the scenes with him becoming a worm god person. Amazing. Especially when he runs.
Like, McAvoy pulls it off.
Yeah.
I don't think a 9-year-old child would, but McAvoy pulls it off.
If you imagine him being 9 years old, it's even more hilarious. But I have to say, him running at the speed of whatever looks more... Not, I don't know how to say it, it looks more okay than the Flash running in the new movies. that's really bad. So he runs better than the Flash. So then he finally meets the Prophet and they have a chat. And I was really looking forward to this.
Yeah,
I was sure this was coming. And I didn't get anything out of it.
It was not as good as it could have been.
Exactly. Yeah. Basically, they talk about the Golden Path. And Paul, like we said, mentions that he couldn't do it. And the son has to do it. And he feels bad for him. All the stuff that we probably expect them to say. And I was very disappointed because I imagined some very tense conversation.
You walked into the desert.
No. Something else as well.
And left us with our crazy aunt.
It wasn't bad, it was just okay.
But it's because Leto is, like, he has all the memories, so he knows why, so that's just, it's not necessary for Paul to explain.
But at the same time, he doesn't have the memories of, like, what happened to him after Leto was born, so...
So does he know that Stilgar stood over his bed and is like, I should kill these children?
Well, he couldn't see the future when he was born, like, he didn't, like, he was... Not consuming spice.
I mean, he saw he wouldn't kill them, so he was like, whatever, Stilgar. Good old Stilgar.
So what's Irulan doing throughout all of this? I mean, I know she's there, but is she doing anything else besides being a quasi-mother figure?
Yeah, she's doing nothing. Like, she's the most useless character.
She's kind of keeping with Jessica and trying to... protect the children. Yeah. I remember she kept talking about, like, helping the children.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Like, she had different allegiances, but she decided to side with her family that... She's kind of sad. Like, again, like, so many sad things in this book. Like, think about Irulan. She was a princess, and then she's forced into this political marriage where the guy doesn't want to do anything with her at any cost. Her husband has children with another woman. She decides that she wants to treat them as her children because she could never have children with him. Like, that's so sad. And then there is the other super sad subplot, which we haven't mentioned, which is... So Duncan, he comes back to Dune. And he wants to save Ganima. And Ganima, like, Stilgar didn't want to bring Ganima away from where they were keeping her in Siege Tabr, because he's faithful to the Atreides, so he's still faithful to Arya, even though Arya is kind of mental. And so Duncan forces him, like, insults him so badly that Stilgar is forced to kill him.
Oh, yeah.
And after that, he's kind of forced to...
Suicide
leave.
By Stilgar.
Because at that point, he has killed Alia's husband. So he has kind of made Alia his enemy. And so now he can finally... Because Stilgar, he had, like, kind of all this internal... Mm-hmm. He had this thing where he wanted to save Ganima. He knew that it was dangerous and he was supposed to protect her. But at the same time, he couldn't go against Alia's orders. And so Duncan sacrifices himself so that he can do it. Which I think it's a really, really cool idea. Like, I would have never imagined, like, the solution to Stilgar's internal conflict to be Duncan doing something like this. And second, again, this is why this book is much, much worse than the second one. Like, think about Duncan. Like, everything that happens to him in this book is horrible.
Right.
Horrible and awful. So, horrible. It's really horrible. Like, his wife goes crazy and cheats on him in any possible way, and his best friend's children are threatened by his own wife, and he wants to be loyal to everyone, but he can't be loyal to anyone. And then the only way he has to save Ganima's life is to get himself killed. That's crazy.
Sorry, is there ever a crazy point when someone is like, okay, we need to do an intervention on Alia? Like, we can see that she's going through something, so we might want to...
Well, that's why Jessica came to June in the first place.
A little too late, right? Like,
yeah, I know, I agree. But I think that's kind of the beauty of it, is that Jessica was never a good parent to her. Like, that is true. Like, she was a very bad parent. And understandably so, but, like, it's, you can imagine why. But she was a bad parent, and, that like, Alia is kind of a victim of the circumstances, and, yeah, like, she, I don't know, she really didn't have any way out of this.
That felt a little bit artificial. Like, she was just... It's possible that I'm reading things to it that there aren't there, but it seemed like from the moment once Alia stops being a child, once she starts being overtly sexual, the narrative abandons her as a, like, oh yeah, she's gone, she's lost. You know, there's no saving her. And when you juxtapose it with someone like Irulan,
sure,
or like. You know, there's like I wouldn't call them mirrors of each other, but like they're on the opposite sides of, like, so this is a woman and this is a woman, and like Irulan, like she wants to be a good wife to Paul and she cannot. She wants to have children with Paul and she cannot. But then she decides to selflessly raise the children, and just like, because like she was intriguing and politicking during June Messiah, and like,
yeah, she tried to get Paul killed.
No more public life, only private life for me. And Alia, she's out there doing public life, doing all her power stuff. She is the regent, and she's a bad regent. She's a bad woman because there is something unstable about her, and it feels like it feels a little unfair on her.
I mean, it is, like, in a way it is. Again, I think one of the reasons why I said to Philip at the time that this was my favorite book is I think Alia's story, it's a tragedy in the sense that it's kind of like Macbeth. She was destined to fail from the beginning. Like, she's not necessarily a bad person, but she was destined to become a person that would do bad. Ever since she was born, like, people just assumed that they didn't need to do anything to her. They were just trying to stop her. In the first book, Jessica is kind of scared of her. In the second book, all that Paul does all the time is just stop doing this, stop doing that. Oh wow, you're training naked with the spinning thing.
Yeah, that's
and
sweet.
Like she's doing amazingly well, and he's like, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. Like, why are you doing that? So people are just trying to stop her and just trying to get her to refrain from expressing her potential. No one is ever trying to support her other than Duncan, I guess. And so then she's bestowed with this gigantic power that she never really asked for. Like, she if I remember correctly, at the end of the second book, she was not happy with the fact that she was forced to become the regent, and she didn't want Paul to leave. So it's not like something she tried to obtain.
Yeah, not
but
at all.
From the second she obtained it, like, she was destined to fail, because it was just unrealistic that she could spend those 16 years, 18 years, 20 years, whatever it was, as a regent for these twins that were exactly like him. But she was kind of being punished for everything she was, and she was never protected by anyone, she was never supported by anyone, and she was never allowed to express her potential in any way, while they're allowed to do all of that. So she's a complete victim of the events, and I think her story is really tragic, but it's really, really beautiful in a way. And like, leading up to the end, where the only act that she has where she truly takes control of her life, it's right at the end when she jumps out of the window, right? That's the only time in her life where she truly decides what she wants to do and how she wants to take a real decision for what is going to happen to her.
Yeah, that's terrible, but that's true.
It's unfair in the sense that it's very cruel.
It's like, I guess, just to say what happens, they confront her, madman Vermin runs in there, defeats everybody, and then confronts Alia as well.
Yeah. Well, before that, Paul confronts her as the preacher. Like, he says a lot of stuff, and then, which is also, again, at the end, please tell me if I have changed your mind on the fact that this book is much, much more tragic than the second one.
Yeah, like, we probably have.
Who has done everything for the Fremen and everything for these people, and they are venerating him as a god. They are adoring him as a god. These people who adore him as a god end up killing him in a brutal way because he's saying the truth about the cult that he, like, his own legend has created, which is so ironic. And by doing so, he also ends, yep, like, his own sister. Mm. But yeah, so they confront Alia, and then she regains control at the last minute from the Baron, and she jumps out of the window.
Which was very tense. I like the ending. Like, it wasn't, yeah, something I expected.
Like, it wasn't the ultimate fight, like, Leto versus... like, if this was done in a movie today, there would definitely be a fight between Alia and Leto, but no, it's just they
yeah,
fight, like, with words, not really with blades, and that's how it ends.
I remember the conversation was pretty, yeah, impactful. Like, it was the meaning, not the action. So that's pretty good. And
yeah,
then Faradin arrives with his mother.
Yeah.
And he finally takes a stand and betrays his mother. So Faradin finally tells her mother to fuck off, basically. And it's like, yeah, a huge moment. But to... in contrast what everybody else has been going through and what's been happening around, and yeah, like, okay,
it is a little bit of a anti-climax in that way,
which I liked, actually, because I feel like his whole character is like that.
But I really liked him. I think he's a cool character.
What feels to him like a giant feat is like nothing to in comparison. So what happens is, we already mentioned, Faradin gets to be with Kanima. Leto is like, by the way, I'll live thousands of years. I'm out. Bye. And
no, he says he will become the emperor, and Ganima will be his wife.
Doesn't Ganima mean like war prize?
Yeah.
In that language.
Yeah. Like in the Fremen language, like Ganima, like Chani chose that as a name, like war prize. Or yeah, that was really weird. I do think
so. Girl.
One of the worst part of this book, and I think also the following ones, is that Ganima's character is totally underplayed. Like, she does almost nothing.
Like, what is her character?
Yeah,
like, she's,
like, we don't really know.
She's the twin who can self-hypnotize herself.
Yeah, that's true. That's a
and
flaw.
She's there as like emotional support for Leto, so Leto doesn't go all over Baron Harkonnen or. What's his face? Sargon of Akkad, or whoever is his Sumerian protector? Just like...
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Could have done better there, Frank.
No, I completely agree. I think she's not used very well. She's not... Like, she could have been very interesting, but she's not. Like, she's just there. To the point where, yeah, they could have just avoided having a twin.
Okay, so in conclusion... I think the reason I don't like this as much is there are clear things that are kind of not as good, like the tigers and the Ganima and the whole worm suit.
I don't mind the worm suit. I don't mind at all. I think talking about it, I remember why I like this book.
I guess the whole Leto thing, that's the inspiration for Jabba the Hutt, isn't it, in Star Wars?
Yeah.
Hmm. All right, so... I think we've done it.
Yeah.
Book 3. Thank you for the discussion. I hope you not exhausted.
No. Yeah. And the next one is going to be the exhausting one. This one was easy.
Yeah, I cannot wait. So if you have time, I'll be happy to talk about the next book.
Sure.
Hopefully I'll read 5 and 6 soon.
I'm not sure what we're going to talk about for book 4.
I have so much to say. Oh my lord.
Yeah, it's either like we talk for 5 hours or we talk for 5 minutes.
I cannot wait. I can have a whole podcast only about book 4.
Okay. Okay.
So please tune in on the next episode. Thank you for listening. And that's it.
Bye.